You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Frances Frey. Frances is a professor at Harvard Business School. She recently served as Uber's first senior vice president of leadership and strategy to help the company navigate its very public crisis in leadership and culture. Frances regularly works with companies embarking on large-scale change and organizational transformation, including embracing diversity and inclusion as a lever for improved performance. Her TED Talk on the topic of building trust has logged over 4 million views. She is the co-author with Ann Morris of Uncommon Service, How to Win by Putting Customers at the Core of Your Business. And they have a new book. It's called Unleashed, the Unapologetic Leader's Guide to Empowering Everyone Around You. Frances Frey, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Kelly. It's a pleasure to see you again.
So we're doing quick check-ins with everyone at the top of the podcast. I am in my house on the northwest side of Chicago. We're doing okay. Are you in Massachusetts?
I'm in my house in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in my wife Anne's office.
Okay, great. So, and we're all seemingly okay for the time being.
Yes.
This book provides a very different approach to leadership. And in my field of improvisation, we talk a lot about the need to be others focused. And I think you have a similar idea in mind when you write, quote, "Leadership at its core isn't about you. It's about how effective you are at unleashing other people. Full stop. That's it. That's the secret."
Yeah. And I do. And having been able to experience the awesome programs that you put in, it just felt like we were just born of the same sentiment and that it is it's other focused. And in that focus, it's how to help people achieve greatness that they like. Our job is to be an accelerant of other people.
Yeah. And I think, again, speaking in this moment, and you and I prior to the podcast were just chatting about all the amazing and sometimes scary things that are going on right now. You talk in the book about, quote, "start taking radical responsibility for the experiences of other people." And that feels like what's going on is this sort of radical reawakening. And you're calling for that in businesses, which I think is great.
Yeah. And I do think, and those words are selected very carefully. You know, sometimes we hire people and then it's like a sink or swim. Like, let's just see who makes it. And that's, I'm like 180 degrees opposite of that. If we bring someone in, imagine if we took radical responsibility for their success so that it endured in our absence. Like, how much more greatness would occur? And so I do want us, and I do agree with you, we're taking responsibility as a society in ways that are super heartening to me, even though they're about devastating things.
Yeah.
And I do think radical responsibility is what is needed in society and in business.
You have another interesting thing where you say, quote, "risk making other people the heroes of your leadership story." That's not something that you would read in business books normally.
I feel like you're going to say that a lot about
No, I am going to say that a lot. Well, because most business books are the great man theory, so right there we have an issue.
Yeah.
but this idea of this is true, the improv concept of make your partner look good. If at all times you're choosing to make your partner look good, you are just going to do yourself the service of looking good, because it's reciprocal. It just has to be.
Yeah. And I do think that, everyone, and Reid Hoffman said this so beautifully, is that everyone is on their own journey. And so if we can focus on them and their journey, and we're the directors and the conductors as leaders. If we try to be the star as leaders, it's not going to work. And so we want other people to be the star of what we're trying to accomplish.
The other area where we cross over in terms of improv and your work in the leadership area is this idea of making mistakes work for you and seeing all obstacles as gifts. This is again a thing that isn't a common way to speak normally in the business world, but is so true to who and what human beings are, because we fail a lot. And especially if you want to be innovative, you're going to want to fail because you're going to want to experiment more, right?
Yeah. And I think that where people sometimes get like taken up with this is that they're like, holy, I could just go and fail for sport. Like, is that what you're asking? And of course it's not. It's that we want you to be learning from, we want you to fail on new things. We don't want you to repeatedly fail on the old thing. We want you to encounter new things. So if you're encountering new things and you're not failing, you're probably not pushing the frontier enough. And we also want to wring out all the learning we can from failure. And probably, and Amy Edmondson has done wonderful work on, like, mm-hmm. should we really call it failure or not? But it's learning from experience. And what I found into going through the improv exercises you did is that you really operationalize it in a way. So, like, I talk about it and I can coach companies, but you viscerally put us in positions where we have to learn from one another. And I love, like, that's a chance of getting into our DNA almost.
Yeah. Well, I mean, improvisation itself is a pedagogy. So you learn by doing, and the doing is uncomfortable. And so we try to, what we're all trying to do is make people comfortable with being uncomfortable, because we push away on it. I gotta admit something. So I read the book. We were supposed to tape a long while ago and had to delay it. I have cribbed one of your lines
from the book,
and I've been using it at the end of my keynotes. So I've been closing my keynotes with this. Quote, we believe the future of work depends on our willingness to exchange the gift of each other's transformation. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. And I've been on panels where people have just stopped in a moment and say, can you say that again?
Yeah. And it's a beautiful sentiment, and I could talk to you about that. But anytime you feel words that are just like they're going to make you tear up, you should just think Anne Morris.
Oh, that's
like
her.
She, indeed, all of the the words that will just really capture you. She's a beautiful writer, a beautiful thinker. But that is anyone who knows us is for sure their thought bubble is, wow, Anne is a great writer. And I don't want anyone to be confused. Anne is a great writer.
but it is beautiful. Like, unpack it.
Yeah. And there is a better version of all of us out there tomorrow than there is today. And it's whether or not we're going to be presumptuous enough to help other people get there. I love transformations. In fact, I was so moved by reading a book by Paulo Freire, a Brazilian really community activist and great educator. But he essentially said, every time you teach, it's a chance for transformation. Mm-hmm. And so in your keynotes, you're teaching. Mm-hmm. Like in the future of work, like we're teaching people about a new opportunity. Let us give the gift of a transformation for that.
We recently aired a podcast with Val Lance Gaffreau, who is the first artistic director of a medical school. And she used to work at the Apollo Center. Yeah, so she's dealt with science and improv. But part of what they realize in medicine is, like, you can't keep up with the science. And so this, by even focusing on a lot on that, it's going to be obsolete by the time these people are working there. So what they are also are focusing on is how they approach learning, how they approach engaging other people in teams. And this book very much speaks to hopefully a way that we will be operating in the future, but we absolutely need to, especially with AI and the development of all the sort of automation. So we're going to be calling on the things that make us most human.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the greatest thinkers I know about AI are Kareem Lakhani and Marco Iancidi, and if you look at their book, it's very much got a leadership lens to it. So all of these things need to be led. It's not going to be like the wholesale, swapping out. But we are going to make advances. Just like in medicine, we're going to make advances in technology and in digital and in AI.
All right, let's dig into a very tricky area.
Oh, good.
That you
Please.
Write about, which is authenticity.
Yes.
So people talk about this all the time, the need to bring your authentic self to work. I talk about it, that why do we check our humanity at the door? And while I'm technically not wrong, people pay a penalty when they bring their authentic selves to work sometimes.
Sometimes. So let me explain when I think that is, and I'll just double click on it for a moment. And that is, first of all, authenticity, like if you're not authentic, that is, if you try to be someone other than yourself, we're going to pick up on it in like a nanosecond. And the first thing that's going to go is we're not going to trust you. So the strategy of not being authentic is an ineffective strategy. I just want to start there. Now, that doesn't mean we have to bring all of our authenticity. So I sometimes talk about that we might want to trim our authenticity, that maybe everybody can't handle all of it. But I don't want to not be it, but I'll leave some of it at home and I'll bring it. But I find that there's a continuum of people, some people who are really not bringing their authenticity at all. And honestly, they tend to be the most underrepresented people in a room. Yeah. And so there we want to set the conditions for it to be safe and welcomed for their authenticity to flourish. And then there are some people that just bring too much of their authenticity and we just like them to dial it down a little bit. And so I just don't want to confuse the prescription I give to the dial downers to those that we need to set the conditions to bring out more of it.
Yeah. When back in the day, when my early days of running Second City, I remember, especially in the box office, because that's the first face that a customer might see or voice that they might hear. I would often say, you know, most of them were actors anyway. And I'd be like, I would appreciate you acting like you actually want to be here and do your job. So and use this as an opportunity to, you know, practice a little bit of your acting. And again, you want to tap in, and I think you're 1,000% right. You, people can smell it. They can tell.
Oh, yeah. Unless you're a professional actor. And so the advice you gave to actors, I would never give to another human being.
No.
Acting, we are just way too sophisticated in 2020. Unless you're a professional, it's too much of a varsity sport.
Yep.
So instead, I think you have to get in touch with your authenticity and find out what triggers your authenticity and try to bring that with you so that it flourishes more. I also feel like those of us that are feeling authentic, it's up to us to set the conditions for those people that are feeling more cautious.
Yeah. That makes me think, let's talk about diversity and inclusion.
Yes, it goes right there.
Yeah. So back in the day, I was always the last person to interview an executive to come in to give the stamp that they would fit in culturally with the theater. In the last 5 years, I have changed my opinion dramatically to the point that when I'm on a panel and someone says, just give me one piece of advice, I say, don't hire for cultural fit. Look, I knew that as a casting person for the stage, you never want to hire a bunch of people who look alike. We'd never do that. But didn't know to make the transition to the boardroom. And you write about that in the book, that cultural fit can be just the worst thing.
I really think it is, but it comes from a good place. And so it's good people doing their best. And so I don't want to condemn anyone from doing it. I just want to give an updated view. And if the problem with a cultural fit, or really any kind of fit, is that it's in the eye of the beholder, and we really like people who are like us. We really do. And it's super hard not to overestimate that. We're also alarmingly overconfident in what will work out well, alarmingly. So I would at least like historical prediction, like I'd like an updating of it. But I find that if you double click on the word fit and you find what we really mean by fit can be operationalized into these five things. And if those five things you can get to a, is it there or not? I don't mind that. So for example, I find if we hire at HBS for cultural fit, it's just going to increase the sameness that's HBS. But there are some distinct things about HBS that we want to hire for that's quite different than hiring for at other places. For example, we like our research to be very close to practice. Mm-hmm. We want practitioners to digest. At other schools, it's okay if academics digest and then academics and then academics and ultimately practitioners maybe even 5 years later. We really like people to be close to practice. That's more of an objective. Teaching is super important to us. And so if you're not energized by the classroom, it's going to be a rough place to be. So I don't mind operationalizing fit and looking for its component parts. But when we aggregate it up to fit, oh, we bring in all kinds of just noise to the estimation. And I find the estimations to be pretty terrible. And and they don't work for, they're better for the majority than the minority.
Yeah. And words matter. And that's something I think that we forget sometimes. Because you write also in the book about the ways of being inclusive of queer identities. You say, assume nothing, get comfortable with fluidity, get educated, ask for pronouns, respect people's privacy, build private bathrooms, remember that family may be complicated or not. This really isn't a lot of work. So I always get surprised about the people who get upset about the pronoun thing. Cause I'm just like, I don't understand why it's like,
but kind of just, so I don't, it's not much work, but we have to understand why we're doing it or else it is work. So I think that many of us weren't given the secret memo. So we tried to write this book as sharing secret memo. So even that like top 10 list is written as a secret memo so that when you read it, you can internalize it and then you don't even have to think about it anymore. And so I feel like many of us received secret memos for things and we forgot to distribute them to others. And so we're just trying to distribute the secret memos to everybody.
That's lovely. We're talking about Harvard Business School. And you discovered that male faculty members were being promoted at twice the rate of female faculty members at the school and actually decided to do something about it, right?
Yeah. And I mean, that's like, we have a line in the book that might be the sharpest line in the book. That is, if you discover something like that and you don't do something about it, it's like inhumane.
Yeah.
Right. So when it was clear to me, I think action is the only noble reaction. And the way to do it is to find out, is to put our like first instincts aside and really get down to the root cause. Because if you can see one group advancing more than another at promotion, it's always can be one of two things going on. We're either making biased decisions or one group was better prepared than the others. Mm-hmm. Now, if I went and interviewed people at the time, and I did, no one lacked confidence in which one it was.
Mm-hmm.
But some people thought it was one, and some people thought it was the other. But nobody thought that like reasonable people could disagree, and they all thought that they were right. And so what we did is went to the root cause of it. And this was, you know, at a moment in time. So it was whatever year we did. And we looked at 15 years of data. And that's because I had been there for 15 years and I knew everybody. And so I could interpret the data quickly. Like it's not any more scientific than that. And, you know, we found out that in this case, men were more prepared than women for reasons that we could then easily overcome, like, and learned that women were, and not all women and not no men, but certainly the central tendency, the 0-1 variable was super significant. that women were holding on to papers longer in this, like, perfect, like their perfectionism was coming out in their preparation of their research papers, which I so get. Whenever I talk to this in the room, like, the women are nodding, like, this is, I see myself, and some of the men are nodding too. But what we didn't, we almost thought our perfectionism was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And here, our perfectionism was preventing us from participating in the improvement cycle of others who could make us much better than we could on our own. And so, and then once you reveal that to people, that's like a new secret memo. And then once you see that, you're not going to stay privately trying to perfect something when you know there are experts out there willing and able to help you break through. So I feel like all of this is getting to the root, understanding it deeply, and then finding an elegant way to describe it simply so that people can take action on it.
Yeah, so I'm curious. So your male colleagues at the business school, their response to getting this data and this evidence, were they what was the response? I'm curious.
Well, so first I didn't, like many of them may be reading about it for the first time.
Oh, really?
Book. No, because I saw this, I was curious about it, and then the men didn't have to change.
No, they
so I didn't. They were doing a great job. They were participating in the improvement process that was the referee process. Uh-huh. And so I went and talked to women, particularly women who I knew were intellectual rock stars, had amazing work ethics, and had very thin CVs.
Yeah.
And I would go and talk to them and ask them about their work and process, and they had tons. And then I said, well, here's what we have seen. And light bulbs would go off in their head, and then they would start to behave differently. So, but I think this might be, you know, people will get to read about it for the first time in this book.
Oh, that's wild. Okay.
Yeah.
You also introduce us to a variety of interesting characters. I was quite taken with a Peruvian billionaire.
Oh, yeah.
Just, you know, Carlos Rodriguez Pastor.
CRP is what.
Yeah, CRP. The mighty CRP. Tell us about this guy. Totally cool.
So CRP is totally cool. I would go ahead and say he's the best leader I've ever come across.
Wow.
And that comes from a mix of nobility. Like, he cares about Peru. He cares about elevating the country. He has done great things to elevate the country. His businesses are all aimed at the emerging middle class. So he started in finance, but then went to every service and every product that the emerging middle class, his schools, the Innova schools, I mean, I will weep when I talk about them. These schools are now, like, they're now graduating people that are going to Stanford that had no means of even going to schools. And these schools are designed just beautifully. He completely believes that the absolute most valuable resource are people. Mm. Everyone will say it, but every one of his actions reveals it. And what we find about great leaders is that you set really high standards and you do it in a way that reveals that you're deeply devoted to their success. And the more devotion you show, the higher the standards can effectively be. So he gets more greatness out of others than anyone I've seen because he is able to do both of those. And he is relentless. So we talk about this great example in the book where he's going around with a senior team and purposely having clown bloomers coming out of his waistband. Mm-hmm. And he's horrified when no one talks to him about it at the end of the day. What beautiful pedagogy. I mean, that's like worthy of your pedagogy.
Well, it's the emperor has no clothes. I mean, it's like it's going back millennia to a thing that we should have picked up on since we've been talking about it forever.
But what I love about the work that you guys do is that you make it so operationally and instinctually real, even if we've known it to be true for a long time. Like, you came up with really creative pedagogy. I found that to be super creative pedagogy. And that's what CRP does in every instance, is he does really, really nice pedagogy of bringing out greatness in everyone. Because that lesson will be imprinted on everyone who was there and everyone who heard about being there.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm going to give credit to Anne on this line then. Quote, he invests in people with unapologetic audacity.
Indeed, you should.
I love that. Yeah.
Indeed, you should.
So here's another thing I love about the book is that you talk about love, which is, again, oddly, when you actually just stop and think about the one of the most powerful emotions that we bring around with us, and you write in the book, quote, the gift of helping someone reach for a better future than the present they're living is among the purest forms of human love we know. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Kim Scott talks about this in Radical Candor, that you can't be radically candid without knowing the person cares personally. You have to love them.
Yeah. And Kim Scott, we are very proud to claim Kim as a graduate of the Harvard Business School. and Kim's message has reached and resonated with millions of people at this point. And I think that's exactly right. I think it's exactly right. We don't usually start with the word love. We usually conclude with it because we don't want to like deter people unnecessarily. But in the end it is love.
Yeah. Yeah. You also write, you talk in the book about part of the reason we use the word gift is because it's not free. To make others better comes at a price for the giver.
And I think that
seems important.
It is really important because often when we say like feedback is a gift, people focus on, oh, I received it as a gift. Mm. Yeah, but really it's an investment. It's not free to do it well, to curate it, to think about like, my whole job of feedback in that, if we're using that as a gift, I was effective if you got better. So there's no such thing in our mind as a difficult conversation. That's like, sounds like you're bracing yourself to do a bad job in giving feedback.
Yeah.
Like it sounds like you're about to give feedback that's going to destabilize someone, which is ineffective. If it's only to make someone better, I got to curate it. And I am investing a lot and it does cost something to do it. And I think feedback is a great instrument of love only when it's used effectively, which is when it's used to make other people better and to help them achieve even more.
Right. And context is crucial. I mean, this is the thing we forget about all the time that, you know, it's like, where are you? When are you? At what point are you? You know, like we know when you're a novice, just learning in classes at Second City, we're not going to like give you hard notes. We're going to cheer for you during every, you know, time you try and just try the thing. But then if you're on like the main stage, on a resident stage, you are craving the deep note for how you can excel and become better. And I believe there's evidence to back that up, right? In terms
Oh, yeah. But what you're doing, what you have behind it is that my job is to make you better. And the context you're in is going to matter. So it's not like I get credit. A lot of people think, oh, but I told them that. I don't care what you said. I care... words came out of your mouth and now I'm going to look, did they get better? If they did, you did a good job. If they didn't, so no credit for I told you so.
No.
No,
I'm just trying to think of that. If that were the way they judged like, you know, managers in Major League Baseball, like, well, I told them to hit the ball. It's like, no, they got to hit the ball.
But in management meetings, you'll hear all the time. Like, oh, listen, I told them that. Okay. Then, we shouldn't have you go and be the messenger anymore because you're ineffective.
Mm. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we do that, I'm very interested in sort of strategy and culture because there's all these different methods out there. And you write in the book that most strategies have an expiration date. That's just true, right? I mean, whether it's Six Sigma or Agile, of course, is a big thing now.
Well, those are techniques and those are like operating models.
Yep.
And those may be enduring. I mean, we repackage them for the time. But from a strategy, like a strategy is how does the organization win and how does it create value for all of its shareholders?
Okay.
Underlying physics of that or the underlying dynamics of that, if a new regulation comes in place, if a new competitor, if a new technology, all of those things are going to change the landscape. And so we're going to need to change our strategy. So I think strategies do have expiration dates and they should be super nimble. Before you go to the yes and, I want to just make sure in here, I want to tell you my favorite thing I learned from improv from when your team came to the Harvard Business School. Can I?
Please.
And yes and is the most famous and I love it. But for me, it was the like palpable learning that creativity and judgment can't coexist.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you find yourself judging someone, you have just given up all license to be creative and helping them. And if you're being creative, it has to be in the absence of judgment. And I have to tell you, I go back to that just again and again and again, that if I'm indulging myself in judgment, it's at the cost of creativity. And if I'm trying to create an environment that's creative, I got to get everybody to suspend judgment. And I from a leadership perspective, I find that to be enormously powerful. So I don't know if there's an and behind you that we get to credit with the words.
There actually is an and behind me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it is. Yeah. It's magnificent.
And Libra often talks about this need to separate analysis from the action, in that, you know, for us thinky people, you know, we love the analysis and we love, you know, getting into that stuff, which is why it tends to infect us throughout the day. But in fact, we're not going to ever hit a flow state if we're sort of looking back and like, am I doing this right? Right? It's like, just do it. So that bias for action, I think this is the other thing. It's like when you, people who are called like naturals,
I don't even know what a natural is. Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
What I do recognize is that some people have this bias for action of like, I'm going to try this out. And if you do that with a good heart and a little bit of wisdom, I think it's going to work out for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I was curious what your sort of big takeaway was, and that is a very important one.
Yeah.
All right. So we always end the podcast by asking our guest for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no, and they actually don't get that far by saying yes. They say yes and, they affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. So do you have a moment in work or life when you yes anded?
And it's a great question, and one that you didn't give me in advance, so people are going to be subject to my thinking real time, which is awesome. So I do. When we were at Uber, and there are existing cultural values there, and the organization saw the cultural values and they took them. And they said, yes, and here's what else we want to have in them. And then people who heard, here's what else we want to have in them, and then will you be more specific? Will you tell us what the harm was? And it was like the building up again and again. And so there were no wrong answers, but there were also no free riders. And what it did is it got us from the old cultural values that had some toxic parts to a new set of cultural values that had kept the original intention, but were able to shed the toxicity. And it was from the contribution of everyone, and nobody free riding and nobody detracting.
That's interesting. I think the idea around specificity, which is huge in comedy, like things are not funny if they're vague. They're funny because they're highly specific. But also
that's super interesting.
Yeah. But also relatable. So there's some truth you're playing with. Like, I see this, I recognize this. So this idea of being very specific, responsible, and showing up in your actions, and there you have culture. Right. I mean, that's when you can get to your good stuff. So I know this, when things are working great at Second City, those are the pages we're on. And when things are terrible at Second City, it's one of those things has been lost. Yeah. And quite frankly, most of those things are the things that get lost. And part of that happens when you get too big. I mean, that's when I'm tracing some of our stuff too, that was a as we begin to scale, as leaders stop knowing what's happening on the floor.
I'm going to say that has simply been the limitations of your operating models, and it needn't be a limitation.
Oh, that's interesting. That's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I look at Microsoft, which has more than 100,000 employees, and its culture is stronger and more poignant in every corner of the organization today than you could possibly imagine.
Wow.
Scale needn't be a problem, but it often is with our old models of doing things.
Yeah. And you can hide out.
And so we have to, and our definition of leadership is about making others better as a result of your presence in a way that lasts into your absence. And so if you can get to the absence part, that takes care of scale.
Oh, let's end on that. I love that. The book is called Unleashed, The Unapologetic Leader's Guide to Empowering Everyone Around You. Frances Frey, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, Kelly, it's just a pleasure to be with you for any circumstance.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.